From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
I think Americans have the very, very wrong impression that Mexican food is all this comfort taquitos. And of course, taquitos are comfort food, but, you know, Mexico didn't have the fry technique until the Spaniards came. We didn't have any fat in this part of the continent, in the American continent. We had only steaming and boiling, cooked on hot stones and like in ovens, but no frying.
Margarita Carillo Arante has spent the last three decades cooking, studying, and teaching traditional Mexican food. Born and raised in Mexico, she's owned multiple restaurants, from Don Emilio in Baja to La Colina in Tokyo. In 2010, she was part of the group that helped get Mexican cuisine added to UNESCO's list of the Intangible Cultural Heritage of Humanity. Her 2014 work, Mexico the Cookbook, was such a hit, she's back with a new project, the Mexican Vegetarian Cookbook. Hi, Margarita.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I'm so happy you could join us. Where did your passion for cooking start and how did you develop it?
Well, my passion for cooking started at home. I come from a very traditional Mexican family, foodie oriented. So since I could reach the stove, my mother allowed me to help her. My grandmother was very much into food. Every summer, she gave cooking classes to all her granddaughters. We are 11. She taught us that through food, through cooking something nice, it's a way to demonstrate love to your family.
I love that she did that. More grandmothers need to do that. You're often described as being an expert in, quote, traditional Mexican food. What is traditional Mexican food by your own definition? And how does it compare to what you feel most Americans think of as Mexican food?
Okay, well, the real traditional Mexican food is the food we have been cooking and eating for a very long time, centuries. And with the local ingredients, moles and sauces made with peanuts, almonds, nogada with nuts. Our food is sophisticated, delicate in many, many, many regions, depending on the region you are.
What kinds of recipes did you decide to focus on for the Mexican Vegetarian Cookbook?
You know, the further back you go into Mexican history, the more vegetarian is the food. In Oaxaca, for example, we have a lot of vegetarian food made with herbs. Also in Michoacán, we do cook a lot with pumpkin seeds. We have a series of energizing pastes made mainly with pumpkin seeds and some of them with chile seeds, chiles and herbs like spearmint, cilantro. You know, it's like an energetic paste. Men take to the countryside to work when they work, and at lunchtime they just heat up the tortillas and spread this paste on the tortillas. And that's what they eat in order to have energy until they come back home and have dinner at home.
It sounds so delicious.
Yes.
The book is organized into various chapters for around meals like breakfast, lunch, salad, soups, entree, etc. I'd love if we could start with breakfast. You have a recipe for something called huevos ahogados, drowned eggs, which
Yes, I love them.
It's very similar in a way to the Middle Eastern dish shakshuka. Could you talk about the Mexican origin of these huevos and what the tricks are to making it?
The thing is that you have fresh eggs so they won't break. too soon. And you make a sauce, either green or red, and cook it in a cazuela. When the sauce is ready, boiling, the flavor is correct, you lower the fire and then break the eggs in the sauce and then add cheese at the end, a little bit of fresh cheese, and leave them to cook the white part of the egg. And then the yolks have to be fresh, and serve them in a soup bowl.
Could you describe what the green version, the green sauce, what that version is made from?
Yes, it's tomatillo, onion, garlic, and cilantro. And of course, green chili, serrano or jalapeño, fresh. And you dry roast them on a comal and then blend them into a sauce, boil them. And when they're boiling, then you break the eggs separately, carefully. And it's the same. You have to serve it in a soup bowl.
So good. Mm. So we're going to move into lunch now. So tell us about your jorroches, a dish that relies on masa harina.
Yes. Well, jorroches are one of my favorite dishes because you have to make like a ping pong or golf ball, and with your fingers, you put your fingers inside it until it has the shape of a little glass. Stuff it with it depends, you can stuff it with roasted pumpkin seeds mixed with chiles, dried chiles, and then close it. And then you cook these jorroches in the black beans broth. And when they are cooked, they come up to the surface. And then on a soup bowl, you serve the jorroches. I like to serve them with quelites, which are the wild edible herbs. And then you put the jorroches and the boiling beans broth to make it like a soup with, well, thicker than a soup. And a little bit of cheese, and if you want, a little bit of cream on top. In Yucatan, they make it with fish also.
So they're kind of like stuffed dumplings.
Like stuffed dumplings, yes, but with masa.
Oh, so good.
They're delicious, especially with the wild greens around it. You make like a nest, and inside this nest, you put the jorroches standing up, and add the boiling bean broth, and they're delicious.
So I'd love to talk to you about huitlacoche. You have a crepe recipe that looks delicious. Here in the U.S., a lot of people may not have had or cooked with huitlacoche. What do they need to know about using this ingredient?
Well, huitlacoche, it's a nature accident. Because, you know, when corns are in the plant, they're looking up to the sun, the cobs. So in the rainy season, it rains a lot in Mexico, especially center Mexico, which is where the huitlacoche is very common. So a few drops of water, somehow they get into the leaves, the corn husks, and get into the core. And with the humidity and the sun, it becomes like a fungus, like a mushroom. And it's been a delicacy since the Aztecs. And we use it for quesadillas, for crepes, for soups, even for bread, for rolls, like cinnamon rolls. But then you put the huitlacoche and they're delicious. You have to add epazote, a little bit of onion, chopped onion, a little bit of green chile, and it's delicious. But the epazote gives it a very particular flavor.
And finally, we're going to come to dinner. What would be a really stunning vegetarian centerpiece dish?
Well, I would go for crepes. of zucchini flour and of with lacoche and mushrooms. And then you make a sauce of poblano and you help it with a little bit of cream. And if you want to make them individual, you have one of each, one crepe of each, and cover them completely with a huitlacoche, with a poblano sauce, and then add cheese on top of it, a little bit of cream, and put them in the oven. And they're delicious.
Thank you so much. You have made me just so hungry, not only to eat, to cook.
Yeah. No. To me too. Also to eat.
Well, thank you so much. This has been just wonderful.
Thank you very much.
That was Chef Margarita Carillo Arronte, author of The Mexican Vegetarian Cookbook. Find a link to her huitlacoche crepes on our website. You know the link. It's kcrw.com/goodfood. And are you wondering where to get huitlacoche for that crepe recipe? Well, Angelinos, meet Carolina Abumrad and Ricardo Olvera, the duo behind Huitla. Every week, they bring fresh huitlacoche from Mexico to Los Angeles. Their aim is to put the blue-tinged fungus on the same pedestal as white truffles from Italy. Already, they're selling it to chefs all over California, and pretty soon, they'll be opening a storefront so that you can buy it too. Hello, you two. How are you?
We're doing well. Good. How are you?
What inspired the two of you to get into this just unbelievably niche business of importing huitlacoche?
Well, during the pandemic, I did several jobs. I worked as like a personal chef. And then I started working with an Italian company to sell truffles to restaurants. And in one of those visits to a new restaurant, I asked the chef what his dream ingredient was. And he said, huitlacoche. And that got me thinking, like, why can't we get fresh huitlacoche in the U.S.? What is the mystery behind this? Why can't we find it anywhere? Or you only see it at the end of the summer at farmers markets. So I started investigating.
I suppose at this point, for people who are unfamiliar with what it is, it would be great if you could describe huitlacoche.
Sure. So huitlacoche is the mushroom that grows on corn, and it is a delicacy in Mexico.
Can you describe what it does to the ear of corn, how different it looks once the fungus has infected the corn kernels?
Sure. So when the fungus infects the corn kernels, it swells the kernels up to like tumor-like galls. And the texture and the pattern is very mushroom-like.
And is there a particular color that is associated with huitlacoche?
The way it looks, it's like a grayish hue to it. Blue, maybe blue-gray. And the galls are, you know, they vary in size. So they're anywhere between 1/4 inch, you know, and they can get as big as, you know, a couple of inches, right? It just depends on how the fungus was able to take over the corn.
Is it wild or can it be cultivated?
Yes, it can be cultivated. Right now in Mexico, they do inoculate many cornfields. It's such a popular thing to eat in Mexico. There's not enough of it that grows wild. So there are companies that inoculate the corn one by one, by the way. It's really quite something how they do it. It's corn by corn. And then it also is harvested that way.
How does your company Huitla work? Are you working directly with farmers or are you shopping the markets in Oaxaca?
So currently we're working with distributors that source it from the different markets, like the Central de Abastos. And we're actually planning a trip down there to meet individual farmers to get a little bit more in depth with our sourcing.
And tell us how it's prepared. Are you bringing it in? Is it still like kind of on the cob or have you already removed it? Sort of take us through the process of what's involved before we can cook with it.
It's not allowed on the cob. We can't import it on the cob. So we buy it what they call desgranado, so just the grains, right? And that whole process is done, you know, after it's harvested and it gets shipped to us off the cob. So we just get the galls. And sometimes the galls do have little pieces of the cob in there, the corn, but mainly it's just, you know, taken off the cob and we get the galls.
So if we can get our hands on some from you, from Huitla, what is like the first thing we should do with it? What is sort of like Huitla Coche 101?
You can actually just cook with it right away, just like a mushroom, actually. So you could chop it up or leave it whole, and I would saute it like in butter. You could make like a scramble with it. I have some chefs making soups, and it's like a choose your own adventure, like cooking with mushrooms. And you don't want to cook it all the way. You don't want to cook it too much.
Why? What happens?
It just like releases a lot of water and it gets soggy. So you don't want to like any mushroom, you don't want to like have it disintegrate.
And Ricardo described the color as being sort of like a grayish to light blue when it's fresh on the cobs. Once we cook it, does that color stay or does it change?
It changes, yeah. So once you start cooking it, inside the huitlacoche, there's a black paste, like a jet black paste. It almost looks like squid ink. And what happens when you start cooking it, well, that starts coming out and it turns black.
Wow. So it seems like it would be a good substitute, like for squid ink for vegans.
Yeah, we have one chef was doing that. He was replacing squid ink with huitlacoche and making a black rice out of it.
So interesting. Is there a signature dish in Mexico where you are most likely to see huitlacoche?
I don't know if there's a signature dish. I think what is common in Mexico is you're walking down the street and you just see these stands and they have quesadillas, right? And that's the most traditional way of eating it in Mexico.
What are some of the creative ways that you've seen chefs use it here in LA?
We have some chefs making ice cream with it, or they make a compound butter, the vegan black rice. We've had chefs make cheesecake with it, a confit, a lacto-fermented sauce, which is really, really nice. A dehydrated powder, so using it like a spice. It's all been very, very interesting.
How exciting. Very exciting to watch an ingredient with such a long history find a new way of expression.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for coming to the show.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
That was Carolina Abumrad and Ricardo Olvera, co-owners of Huitla, an import company bringing fresh huitlacoche from Mexico to Los Angeles every week. Keep an eye out for their brick and mortar bodega coming soon. And until then, we've got all the details on how you can order some on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, another delicacy from Mexico that we all know and love, the tortilla. We hear from a pioneering LA tortilleria next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. It's no secret that we love masa. I mean, is there anything more comforting than a basket of warm tortillas? I do not think so. When they started Kernel of Truth Organics, Ricardo Ortega and Omar Ahmed dreamed of a day when organic tortillas made with just three ingredients, corn, cal, and water, would become the norm. With Kernel of Truth, they have given Angelenos exactly that, access to fresh tortillas made with quality ingredients. Ricardo shares their story in this week's In the Weeds.
So hi, my name is Ricardo Ortega. I am one of the co-founders of Kernel of Truth Organics, a tortilla provider here in the greater Los Angeles. So the origins of Kernel of Truth was really on my business partner's side, Omar. His family had the original tortilleria back in the early 90s, late 90s, early 2000s in Echo Park. And once the family decided to no longer continue the business for one reason or another, he kind of picked up the masa ball where it was left, and I came in, you know, us knowing each other for a very long time. We got together and said, well, let's pick up this family business and let's give it a go. This was in somewhere near 2015 was really when we first started. We then said, okay, we're gonna use the best corn that we can find. We're going to not add any of the additives, and that should be our kernel of truth. When we first started, we were putting in a lot of hours. I mean, the process of tortillas is cook the corn, let it soak for X amount of hours, get up the next day, wash it, grind it, turn it into tortillas, and put it in your car and hit the road. I think we were putting in 20 hours straight. We were really taking turns on sleeping. He would sleep for a while, I would sleep for a while, and it was all in the name of tortillas. So our biggest hurdle in our operation really was dissecting what a true tortilla should be, even before we offered it to anybody. You know, the tortilla in the big industry is chock full of gums, additives, softeners, preservatives. The running joke with Omar is there's more corn on the logos than there is in the actual tortilla. So that for ourselves was, okay, we need to make sure that we can deliver a good tortilla that is shelf stable to a degree and that our clients will want to use. And that was really one of our biggest hurdles is creating a clean tortilla. Our production process is a two-day operation. It's really one day to get all our numbers in, all our orders in, and then we have to calculate how much corn we need to get that yield. And so once we tabulate all that, we send it to the cook. The cook goes ahead and cooks said number of pounds of corn. It's cooked in water and cal. It's left to soak. The next day we get up, drain the corn, wash it, put it into the molino, you grind it, you add some water, you mix it with water and the corn dough. You throw it into your mixer to create a good consistency in water content and in texture. From there, you throw it into your oven, which is connected to a tortilla die cutter. You put a ball of masa in there, turn on the cooking oven and the cutter, it'll cut them like a cookie press, run it down the oven conveyor, out into the cooling line, hitting it with fans to cool it down because they come out really hot. And on the other end is the counting team and making sure that the tortilla is to specification, not too heavy, not too thin, and that the packs are nice and tight. The minute you pick up your ball of masa, and you open up the bag, you shouldn't smell any acidity. The acidity is all the preservatives. Our masa is made with maíz and cal. The cal gives it a strong aroma, and mixed with the maíz, it's also very aromatic. So you shouldn't smell anything sour. What you should smell is corn. The blue corn, I always liken it to an earthy flavor. It's very earthy. It almost tastes like soil. It has the blue pigment in it. It has the anthocyanins. It gives it a more fickle personality. It likes to spoil. Its shelf life is not that like of yellow corn. Yellow corn is a little bit more stable. And the yellow one, the yellow varietal tortilla, oh my gosh, that one is rich and nutty. It reminds me of fava beans sometimes, like roasted fava beans. The funniest thing that I've encountered with sharing our tortillas with family, particularly my mother, she's gonna hate me for this, they're so used to mass-produced tortillas. I often go to their home, check their fridge, and I try to stock them with our tortillas, but you'll find that very popular brand that's out there everywhere. And when I ask them, why do you not, you know, switch over? The first thing is, well, it's everywhere we go. The second thing is, well, it's really cheap. And then the third is, we're used to the taste. Yours is very corn heavy. We're not used to it. So something that, and I've heard that time and time again, which leads me to believe that, you know, these big corporate names out there have really desensitized our palate to the tortilla. And it's unfortunate because when you use Guerrero and when you find it in your home, I find it in my mother's home, that just means you don't know what a tortilla tastes like. Running a small tortilla business with all the competition around us, with Gruma and with all the political ties around surrounding that, it has become very difficult. One, we had to establish what we were. Are we a tortilleria? Are we a brand? And we've tried it all. And it's been hard. It's been hard to be the small guy. I think luckily we have a lot of resources in Boyle Heights. You know, we're not that far away from other tortillerias that have come in to rescue us when equipment goes down, when there's no corn available, when emergencies happen. So even though we have these big, big corporate names out there that are kind of muscling in, it's the producers that are run by families who kind of are saving grace. When you fold up that tortilla and or make a taco out of it and you put it in your mouth and you take those bites, you know, just please try to remember that hardworking people with families work very hard to get that done, to put it on your plate. And it goes down from the farmer to the tortillero. I know from firsthand experience that tortilla making is one of the hardest things to do, primarily because of the heat. And you're constantly moving around and you're conducting an orchestra. And you want to make sure that it all comes together. And it's that final piece of the pack when you pick it up, you check all the parameters of it, and when it's good, it shines. And there are no new tortilleros out there, none that I know. It's a dying skill that the kids are not picking up. So I hope more attention is given to tortillas so that hopefully tortillerias in Los Angeles and elsewhere can secure their team.
That was Ricardo Ortega along with Omar Ahmed. He co-owns Kernel of Truth Organics. We've got a list of where to buy their tortillas on our website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood.
Los Angeles is such a meat market, but we're not talking about dating. We mean that literally. In the last few years, as appreciation for the craft of butchery has grown, LA has been blessed with a crop of new carnicerias and meat markets. Many of them offer prime cuts that were once difficult for consumers to find. Journalist Lexis Olivier Ray wrote about 11 of the best ones for LA Taco. Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, we were so happy to see your article. So Lexis, let me ask you, what makes a great carniceria?
I think a few things. First off, proximity. I mean, if you live on the east side, you're probably not going to drive or commute all the way to the west side to buy a piece of meat. Inventory is really important. I like to see cuts of meat that I don't typically see at mainstream grocery stores. Price is really important as well. I don't think all meat or all premium good cuts of meat necessarily needs to be expensive. So I'd like to see a range of prices from low to high. And then another thing that I think is really important is getting to know the people behind the butcher counter, having a relationship with your butcher. You know, back in the day, people had a relationship with a butcher that was similar to the relationship with their barber or bank teller or even like a doctor or, you know, dentist. They're people that you know. They're people that look out for you, give you little discounts, order things special. So I think those things are what make a great carniceria.
What I found so interesting from your article was that you mentioned that, you know, until recently, really sort of the highest end meats were reserved for, you know, restaurants or bougie, as you call them, butcher shops. I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that in carnicerías, you can get cuts of Wagyu or prime and other premium meats. What do you think has prompted this response from butchers who work in carnicerías?
I think a couple of things. I mean, demand for one has gone up, I would say. Up until recently, you could only really find Wagyu and prime cuts of meat either online or, like I mentioned in the article, bougie butcher shops, high-end restaurants. But not everybody wants to order steak online and wait for it to ship. A lot of people actually want to go into a meat market, you know, examine the meat that they're going to buy, consult with the butcher, get tips on how to cook it. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of people switch from ordering online to shopping at retailers. And then also supply has definitely increased, I would say. Australian and American Wagyu has gotten a lot better, in my opinion. I remember when I first started seeing Australian Wagyu, it was, you know, more comparable to just kind of like a choice steak that you'd see at a grocery store. But now you see cuts of Australian Wagyu that are almost indistinguishable from Japanese Wagyu, in my opinion. And then also, it's not just wealthy people that are eating high-end meats. We highlighted a number of places that, you know, cater to more working class people. And, you know, you're starting to see butcher shops in neighborhoods that you wouldn't expect to see.
Yeah, that was my favorite part of your story, is it gives us really great insight into what's going on all over the city. And I think people might be surprised that close to them are these really great resources. The geographic diversity is really fabulous. So let's start with Carniceria HQ in East Hollywood. Tell us about owner Ramiro Maldonado. How has he updated the family business and what is he offering?
Sure. Ramiro took over the family business early this year after his, or last year, I guess, after his father passed away, sadly. Before that, he actually worked as a computer engineer, but his family, they've owned carnicerias all over LA for decades. And Ramiro was the one that switched over to carrying these premium cuts of meat and Wagyu steaks. For a while, he was offering them at three locations. There was a location just down the street from me in MacArthur Park, which was pretty surprising to see, you know, high-end Wagyu steaks being sold in a neighborhood like MacArthur Park. He's known for selling Creekstone Farms Black Angus beef, which is known to be some of the best prime beef out there. And he also makes this really incredible beef chorizo. And he actually uses the trimmings of the Wagyu and prime beef that he makes. It's a Oaxacan-style beef chorizo, which is excellent. And it's very difficult to find a beef chorizo that's good. And I've never seen a beef chorizo that's made with Wagyu and prime beef trimmings.
That's pretty amazing. You say in the article that he also carries Jidori chicken and Kubota pork.
Yes, he does. He carries a lot of stuff. And, I mean, that's actually my local butcher shop. Ramiro's the type of butcher that will, you know, order things for you special. We were talking recently about him maybe getting Cornish hens in. He gets duck sometimes. So, yeah, he definitely carries more than just beef.
And what do they do on the weekends that's a little special?
Oh, they also make chicharron as well.
How fun. And for our listeners in the San Fernando Valley, you recommended a spot called Ziggy's. Tell us about that.
Yes, yeah. Ziggy's also really has a really great backstory. The owner, Sicredo, he learned the ins and outs of butchering at the age of 11 years old. 6 years later, he fled to America and landed a job at a meatpacking place where he, you know, learned the ins and outs of the business. 10 years later, he was able to start his own business at the age of 25, which is just mind-blowing to me. And he's been thriving ever since.
That's awesome. You name-check Amboy Quality Meats in Chinatown. What can we expect when we go there?
You can expect some of the best burgers in LA, for sure, as well as some really affordable steaks. On the burger side, they have, you know, your classic smash burgers. They also do this massive 10-ounce dry-aged beef burger that I haven't personally tried, but I've heard from a lot of people that's really good. The beef hot dog is excellent, and I believe all their fries are cooked in beef fat, so they're delicious. They recently just started serving breakfast, so they offer spam bowls and a spam breakfast sandwich. And then on the meat side, they carry Snake River Farms, which is American Wagyu. I think they really stand out for being affordable. Most of the steaks that they carry are between like $20-$25. So you can, you know, go for a burger and then walk out with a nice steak to cook later in the week.
In Southeast LA, you highlight the chain La Carnicería Meat Market, owned by José Luis Ruiz. You wrote that this tiny carnicería in Southeast LA single-handedly changed the game for backyard carne asada in Los Angeles. How did they do that?
Yeah, first off, I want to give a shout-out to my editor, Javier Cabral. He was the one that wrote that little blurb and introduced me to La Carnicería Meat Market. I believe they were the first retailer to really offer prime-grade flat meat and chuck steaks, which are some of the best cuts to use for carne asada. Not only that, but they also offer it at an affordable price. I think recently I saw on their Instagram stories that they were selling asada meat for like $10.99 a pound, which is cheaper than a lot of choice steaks that you'll find at the grocery. I think the success of La Carnicería really highlights that Latinos and working class people also enjoy high quality cuts of meat. Good meat isn't just for rich people.
Moving a bit westward, what are some more meat markets we might find?
So in Santa Monica, we have a place called A Cut Above. Eddie Shin, he's the lead butcher over there. He's self-taught and has also been a chef for over 20 years. They're similar to Amboy Meats. So in addition to carrying prime cuts of beef, they also serve sandwiches. So you'll find house-made pastrami sandwich, a Cubano with slow-cooked caributo pork shoulder. And then they have some specials that include beef hot dogs, yadori wings, breakfast sandwiches. Also on the west side in Santa Monica, I should have probably included Bob's Market. They're a favorite among locals and been open since 1965. And then, not sure exactly where, you know, Central LA ends and the West Side begins, but you also have Standings, which is a newer butcher shop. And they really stand out to me because I believe they're a whole animal butcher. And they also offer classes so people can learn to butcher their meat at home.
Yeah. I find that whenever I go to Standings, for example, if I'm just buying like a treat for myself, I'll zero in on something that I see in the case that's little, you know, that's one portion, not like a tomahawk steak. And yeah, then I just ask them, what is that? What do I do with it? And then you end up learning.
Yeah, yeah, yep. Trust your butcher.
It's been great talking to you, Alexis. Thank you so much for coming
Likewise.
On the show.
Likewise, thanks for having me.
That was Alexis Olivier-Ray, talking about his story, The 11 Best Meat Markets and Carnicerias in Los Angeles for LA Taco. You'll find a link to his piece on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, well, LA may be a meat market, but we love our veggie sandwiches. Learn about three spots giving Sprouts the makeover they deserve when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. I can't remember the first time I had a veggie sandwich. Growing up in LA in the 60s meant they were ubiquitous, and for me, a kind of pushback against my mother's favored liverwurst or salami. I'm sure that the Source Cafe was the first place I bought one for myself with my own money. That combo of cucumber, cheese, and sprouts is still comforting to me, so I order one for my local Yummy a couple times a month. We all have our vices, right? That vegetal freshness and the crunch is like coming home. Tejal Rao, critic at large at the New York Times, joins us to talk about new takes on the classic. Hi, Tejal.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure, especially you talk about this. I mean, this is such a... every time I order a veggie sandwich, I always feel like I should have some level of shame or that it's kind of like this intimate secret that I'm keeping.
I know. There's this sense of having to apologize for enjoying sprouts, but when I was working on this story, I tried really hard not to do that. You know, I read Jonathan Kaufman wrote a really wonderful book called Hippie Food, and he had this very indulgent description of sprouts. He said, alfalfa sprouts smell as if a field of grass were having sex. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, maybe we've been looking at this the wrong way all this time.
Yeah, and as a person who was sort of eating them in situ during a time that they kind of splashed onto the scene, I have to say, who thought about, you know, eating raw sprouts before that? Nobody ate alfalfa sprouts before the veggie sandwich. Can you set some boundaries for us? What defines a quintessential California veggie sandwich?
Yeah, and yes, that's a really good place for us to start. Okay, so the sprout sandwich is inclusive of a rainbow sandwich, a hippie sandwich, the avocado sandwich, and the California sandwich. These are all very closely related, overlapping categories of sandwich, and they may or may not be vegan, but they'll almost always have a few different kinds of vegetables and then a big mass of sprouts kind of compressed in the bread. And sometimes the bread is very grainy and dense. Sometimes there's avocado, sometimes there isn't. There might be tofu, there might be cheese, but the sprouts are a constant. You know, there's that famous scene in Annie Hall that pokes fun at it, where Alvy Singer sits down at the Source and says something like, I'll have the alfalfa sprouts and the mashed yeast, you know, because what could be more LA?
And we were rightfully outraged.
Yes, exactly. I mean, basically until the 70s, only Southern Californians ate raw alfalfa sprouts. I did find a recipe from as early as 1953 in a promotional cookbook published by El Molino, which was an old stone ground mill operation in Alhambra that sold grain and flour to health food shops. And their recipe is 2 pieces of rye bread, mayonnaise, 1/4 inch of alfalfa sprouts. That's it.
How punitive.
Yeah. Yeah, we're really lucky. These sandwiches have gotten so much better.
but I don't know. Even that I find kind of charming in its own way.
Yeah, I do too. You know, you were just talking about the ones you remember. I remember eating them in college and they were a little bit dry and under-seasoned and squelched in plastic wrap. And they weren't the greatest sandwiches, but I remember those versions very fondly.
Has the sandwich itself changed?
There's so many different versions. I do think of, you know, I think the bread has gotten so much better. The one at Friends and Family, Daniel Mattern's sandwich there, is delicious in part because Roxana Julepat's bread for that sandwich is so wonderful. It's this like slightly dense, grainy, close-set bread made with a mash of sprouted grains and sunflower seeds, flax seeds, pumpkin seeds, some real hippie bread.
And what does he have inside between the 2 pieces of bread?
In that one, there's mashed peas, sliced avocado, cucumber and sunflower sprouts. And then there's a nice thick layer of salty feta cheese in the middle of all of that.
I've never ordered that there. I'm going to have to now.
It's really good.
The idea for the mashed peas is really smart because maybe it makes it cohere a little bit more.
Yeah, it helps. It helps everything kind of exactly. It helps the sprouts especially stick together. And I think because the sunflower sprouts are a bit bigger, you make a little bit less of a mess with them, if that's important to you.
Yeah, I mean, alfalfa sprouts always make you feel that you're kind of like a horse grazing. So let's talk about let's continue our veggie sandwich tour of LA. We went to friends and family. Where are we going next?
Oh, let's go to Bub and Grandma's. Zach Jarrett has a really wonderful sandwich there. On the menu, it's called a rainbow sandwich. It's made with Bub and Grandma's own sourdough bread. And then right against the bread, there's a spread of sunflower seeds and garlic confit. And the sandwich is full of cucumbers, beets, carrots, and then a bunch of alfalfa sprouts and some fried tofu that almost tastes like... it belongs in a banh mi or something, a really delicious kind of turmeric-stained fried tofu.
Mmm, that sounds wonderful. All of those root vegetables, I would imagine they're just shaved really finely.
Yeah, they're sort of shredded. Yeah, exactly.
And is there another one that you'd like to share with us?
Yes, I love the, it's called the Ira Glass at Wax Paper. That's Peter Lemos's sandwich shop. This sandwich is absolutely magnificent. It's filled with pickled and raw onion, avocado, cucumber, grated cheddar cheese, and then a really, really thick cushion of sprouts, and everything's drizzled in like a very garlicky aioli. That is a really wonderful one.
And what is the bread on that sandwich?
Actually, the bread on that sandwich is Bub and Grandma's sourdough.
So good. Sometimes I think that all of these sandwiches should be put into pita bread because it would make them easier to handle. But then
yeah.
I would miss kind of the crumbled pieces of bread that you kind of get to eat as a dessert almost as you've worked your way through. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Evan.
Tejal Rao is a critic at large at the New York Times. We've been talking about the enduring appeal of the veggie sandwich. Coming up, the Crenshaw Farmers Market has a brand new location and a lot to offer. It's the Market Report next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. It's time for our weekly Market Report. This week, Jillian Ferguson is at a new farmer's market at Crenshaw and Slauson.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I'm reporting today from the brand new location of the Crenshaw Farmers Market. Today is the market's third week here in front of historic Fire Station 54 on Crenshaw Boulevard at Slauson. And I'm talking with Marie-Elise Rakasner-DeMarco, who has spent many years managing the market in the old location. Marie-Elise, it's great to finally meet you in person, and congrats on the new market.
Thank you very much, Jillian. Thanks for coming out.
Absolutely. So this new location is a huge deal because people driving by can actually see you. You suddenly have a lot more visibility than you did before.
Absolutely. I mean, we knew that that was going to be a major positive factor in moving it to the street. But not only that, but the new K-line, we will be visible from the K-line. We're roughly smack dab in the middle of the Hyde Park neighborhood, View Park, Windsor Hills, the Crenshaw Baldwin, I think it's called Baldwin Vista. We're sort of smack dab in the middle of everything.
And give us a quick rundown of the history of this market. When did the Crenshaw Market open?
Sure. It opened in 2005. It was at the time located in Leimert Park Village in the parking lot of the Vision Theater before its refurbishment started. Then we were moved over to the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza. Things went fairly well there, and then we were moved to a location that just didn't work for the farmers market. We then relocated to another location that worked better, but we were still getting, I kid you not, like six people a week saying, oh, I've lived here for 30 years. I didn't know there's a farmer's market in the community. So we were really looking for visibility.
So I'm looking at the market right now. It looks like you've got a good mix of prepared food vendors as well as farmers. Tell us a little bit about who's here.
Yes, we have our, I almost want to call them vintage farmer, vintage farmer's market food vendor, and that would be Delmi's Pupusas. They do pupusas and tacos. I know that sort of pupusas are ubiquitous to farmers markets, but these guys are amazing. We have Kathy's Kitchen. She's local. And then our farmers. We've got wonderful farmers that have been with us from the very beginning, CNL and Castellanos Farms. We have a local, hyper-local backyard farmer that is Major Mark Microgreens, and it's in the title what she grows at. Let me see, who else do we have? Oh, Don Betos, the most amazing eggs. And CNL has them too, so come on over for your eggs. And we'd had organic, certified organic farmers before, but we just brought in a new one, and that is Sunrise Organics, and I'm so excited because she's got everything.
Yeah, her stuff is beautiful. And this is something we don't talk about enough on the market report, but all farmers markets in the Los Angeles area do accept CalFresh EBT benefits. But your market goes beyond that. You do something called Market Match. Tell us what that is.
Sure. Market Match expands the ability of somebody who's on CalFresh to buy more fruits and vegetables. So we match your CalFresh or SNAP benefits, because if you're from another state, you can use your SNAP benefits here too.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I love telling people that. But anyway, you're able to we're able to match you dollar for dollar up to $20. Fruits, vegetables, honey, eggs, things that are not, you know, not hot foods that you're taking off to go, but and not prepared foods, but things that are, that you can turn a meal into a meal.
All right, Marie-Elise, well, thank you so much for all that you do for the community, for the farmers.
It's funny, it's selfish. I'm not doing it from a community. I'm doing it so I don't have to go very far to go grocery shopping. Completely selfish.
Well, I think a lot of people appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That was Marie-Elise Rikasner-DeMarco on a very exciting day. It's the third Saturday at the new location of the Crenshaw Farmers Market. We're here at Crenshaw and Slauson. The market's open every Saturday, rain or shine, from 10 to 3 p.m. Samantha Watson is one of the vendors here at the Saturday Crenshaw Market, and every week she's bringing produce with Sunrise Organic Farms in Lompoc. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for coming out. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here. Tell us a little bit about Sunrise Organics. What's the backstory of the farm?
The backstory of the farm, so pretty much everyone who works for Sunrise used to work for a guy named John Givens. He's kind of a veteran in the industry. Jesus and his brothers kind of helped him build, you know, his empire in organic agriculture. And a lot of the people that exist today all kind of originally started with John. So in 2015, they went, wait a minute, we know how to do this. Let's go do it for ourselves. So the family broke off and started Sunrise, along with Andrew Gibson, who's kind of the brain behind it all. I've been with them for going on 4 years now, just kind of helping them build and get into more farmers markets, you know, spread with the community like Crenshaw here. We have 240 acres now, all certified organic, which being around since only 2015 is pretty incredible. They're really, really doing a great job. And we grow over 270 different varieties of products throughout the year.
Unbelievable. So, yeah. Well, let's talk about all those products, because your table is very colorful. Just go down the line and tell us what's here.
So my favorite thing that we've got on this table right now is going to be our carrots. All of our carrots are heirloom varieties. They're all really, really, really old seed that we've preserved over the years. And they're honestly the sweetest carrots you can find. Like, people come back and they're like, okay, Sam, you weren't playing. These are good carrots. The orange ones are going to be obviously the sweetest, you know, your classic Nance variety. But then we've got some purples, which are going to be much richer in antioxidants, lower in sugar. They're great for gut health, the immune system. We've also got a yellow white carrot, which honestly is kind of even sweeter than the orange. It's kind of like comparing a yellow peach and a white peach. It doesn't taste as much like a carrot, but it's sweeter. So those, hands down, that's my favorite thing on the table right now. Next, we've got our broccoli, green broccoli. We also do a purple broccoli, which I don't have today. Again, really fun. One woman asked me one day, she's like, did you dye this? I'm like, no, ma'am, we did not. but, you know, we grow, you know, Jesus being in this industry since he was a kid, Jesus is our head farmer. He likes to grow things that other people don't have. and he's got the knowledge to do that. You know, with farming, you could be in this industry for 40 years, 50 years, and all of a sudden you grow a seed that you've never interacted with before, and it's like growing a whole new thing. Mm-hmm. So he likes to challenge himself like that and grow things that a lot of other people don't.
And there's also a sleeper hit on your table, the kohlrabi. It's this funky purple vegetable over there. Tell us about that.
My dad calls them lawn darts.
Because they have that spiral pattern.
Yeah, totally. They look like you chuck them and they'll stick to the wall. But yeah, kohlrabi is like one of the most underrated vegetables. It grows really well in a colder climate. You can take off the skin on the outside, so it's almost like a ball, and then take like a cheese grater and shave it over a salad. You can roast it. It's kind of like broccoli stem, sweet, crunchy. But when I say that, even that's kind of an underrated statement as to what it really is. It's one of those things that people walk up and say, "What is that?" Or they say, "Oh my God, you have purple kohlrabi." So it's one of the two reactions.
It's an attention grabber. So Samantha, how many markets do Sunrise do in the LA area?
Oh man, I want to say we're going on like 13, 14 now. Yeah, you know, we never really wanted to be the farm that was at a million different farmers markets. But anymore, things that are direct to consumer is the only way to survive as a small farm. Unfortunately, with where, you know, conventional agriculture is going, and even organic agriculture in the wholesale world, you know, you have to price match farms that are outside of the U.S. So their production costs are significantly less than ours. So things like farmers markets that are direct to consumer is the only way farms at our size are really surviving, unfortunately. But I'm a huge fan of that, because with being here allows me the opportunity to provide that additional level of education that you don't get unless you're just simply in the industry. And that's why I love being over here in Crenshaw, because it's spreading awareness about different varieties of things that you don't see in the grocery store, the importance of them, increasing access to them. You know, I say all the time, it's not that people don't want to eat healthy. A lot of them just don't know how. They don't know where. They don't know when. They don't, you know, so they come to me and I'm like, come this way, I'll show you. I'll take you there. But it's a really, really cool thing to see that light turn on for people of like, oh, I've never even seen these before. To be here, it's an honor. I love doing it.
Wow. Well, you were an incredible ambassador for produce. Thank you, Samantha.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Samantha Watson. She's here at the Crenshaw Farmers Market every Saturday with Sunrise Organic Farms. Come pay them a visit. They have an incredible array of vegetables as well as some fruit. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laryl Garcia, Elena Shatkin, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Chrissy Van Meter, Laura Kondarajan, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. There's still time to visit the Crenshaw Market today. They close at 3. You could pick up some eggs, maybe get that incredibly weird and delicious vegetable, kohlrabi. And they have Aris, the great kefir yogurt vendor there too. My personal favorite is the lemon. Be well, everyone. I'll be back next week with an all new episode of Good Food.